Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
BlakeRadio.com. And today's show is The Rehab Swindle. This is really incredible. When I went to medical school in the dark ages, that would be 1983, when I graduated, we were taught that, rehab was difficult, but that it was needed and was effective, and people who had drug problems should go to rehab, and if they did not go to rehab, and they were somehow neglecting their health and being irresponsible. At the same time, they told us that the success rate for rehab, so someone went to inpatient rehab, they had in-state a month, then they would have to do 8 rehabilitations, on average, go to rehab 8 times in order to successfully abstain from drugs. Now, this is pretty shocking because most people don't have 8 tries or 8 opportunities to go with this. But first, let's take a look at what is rehab, what really is meant by that. Well, by rehab, I'm referring to inpatient rehabilitation. That's a situation where a person goes to a facility, stays overnight and for a particular length of time with the intent of no longer needing drugs or no longer using drugs. And in the case of rehab, that appears to be, an issue here. So I decided to take a look at what is really going on and if things had really improved since 1983. This 1 in 8, which would be a 12.5% success rate, is that really the case, or have things gotten worse? Or maybe even better. So let's take a look. Let's see what's what. So as always, in preparation for these shows, I dig deeper. Now, starting at the very superficial level, drug and alcohol rehab is touted as less expensive but more effective than incarceration. And we'll get to the bottom of that later on in the show. That's a shocking outcome there, so stay tuned for that. So there's a huge story behind this story. But rehab is a treatment that costs from $8,000 to $120,000 a month. So why would someone pay $120,000 a month for a service instead of paying $8,000 a month when the effectiveness is essentially the same, whatever that is, it's the same? And so I started researching this, and it turns out that for $120,000 a month, a celebrity can have total privacy and escape the prying eyes of their fans and have incredible amenities. And really, this is the reason for paying $120,000, because apparently they're both equally either effective or ineffective, however you want to take a look at it. So now, as I started digging, what did I find out? Well, first of all, there's a baseline recovery rate of 12.5%, which is what it has been for some time. There's no evidence that has increased. So all the people who go to rehab, when I say incomplete, but who go to rehab a year later, 12.5% will no longer be using drugs. Now, we're not talking about 2, 3, 5, and 10-year success rates. This is just 1 year, which many people will probably consider to be a rather modest goal once you've peeled off $8,000 a month for 8 tries. So then I found that the recovery rate with outpatient do-it-yourself rehab, that means you just sit at home and say, you know what, I'm through with drugs, I'm done. That success rate at the end of the 1 year period is 25%. So going to rehab can actually decrease your chances of recovery. Well, that was a shock to me. Rehab making things worse? How could that be? You're listening to the Time for Station Identification, listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul channel at PlateRadio.com. Please visit our sponsor, You Have the Guts to Be Beautiful. This anti-aging book is available at vitalitycapsules.com/truth-file. Get your copy of Dr. Daniels' book that has helped men and women look and feel 20 years younger. So be the first in your circle to get those envious inquiries and those admiring glances. Get your personal paperback book, free shipping, at vitalitycapsules.com/truth-file. As always, I welcome your calls and questions. Please call in at 914-338-0695. Also, those of you who missed the last half of last week's show, it is now posted at the same page, vitalitycapsules.com/truth-file. So, basically, the higher price places, people are paying that money. You wonder, are they gullible? No, they're not. They figure that since the care is ineffective anyway, they might as well get the amenities and network while in rehab. So the degree of success is related only, apparently, to the person's motivation to kick the habit, not to anything else. Now, a problem with rehab is that it focuses on something called a symptom, the drug use. The underlying problem is never addressed. And the unfortunate case of Whitney Houston, her very competent and capable doctors ignored the underlying problem and prescribed even more dangerous drugs, leading to her death. So, what happens at rehab? Well, people are encouraged to quit illegal drugs and then given even more lethal prescription drugs. That's one scenario, and that's the one that, unfortunately, Whitney experienced. And so it goes something like this. Person goes into rehab, and they're told that the drugs they're taking are, of course, illegal, very dangerous for their health, and they need to quit right now, immediately. And when they do that, they don't feel well. They might feel a little jittery, in which case, of course, need a sedative. Then they notice they're feeling a little depressed, in which case, need an antidepressant. And then at night, it's tough to sleep, in which case, need a sleeping pill. And so people can literally leave rehab hooked on a whole new set of drugs. But, again, these are legal drugs, and they're written by, prescriptions are written by a physician. But nevertheless, the addiction remains. So, people are also sent to rehab by courts as a sentencing option. So, wait a minute, how is it a government concerned about citizens' health could allow the force of the court to be used to compel citizens to submit to a process that is documented to be less effective than no intervention? So if recovery is the goal, the court should mandate that the person go home and follow a do-it-yourself plan of their own choice. Why not? Clearly, the welfare of the citizen patient is not a consideration. Further, why should it be a covered health benefit if it is of no benefit? Why should any government agency pay for rehab? Well, from the government's point of view, it's a pretext to increase already high taxes that citizens are paying, and also another pretext for more intrusion into the lives of citizens. Now, one thing to take a look at in terms of rehab is how big a problem is this? So how many people every year die from illegal drugs? There's all kinds of estimates. The best I was able to get is about 17,000 people in 2010 died from use of illegal drugs. How many of them from marijuana? None. So we're talking about cocaine and heroin in terms of it being a health problem resulting in death. But we've got to include marijuana when we talk about rehab, because a lot of rehab includes marijuana use. So we've got a government recommending what it knows to be ineffective therapy. I can't imagine that nobody in the government is aware of this, how ineffective this is. So in medical school, let's take a look at what causes addiction to drugs. In medical school, I was taught, and the belief is even greater now, that there was a scientifically proven drug for every unpleasant mental mood. If a person was sad, then they could take an antidepressant. If they were agitated, it was a sedative. If it was really bad, they needed a tranquilizer. If they were hearing voices, they needed an antipsychotic, and so on. So then I noticed that some drugs were in more than one category, and there was no reasoning as to which one to use when. This really bothered me, but I had confidence. I was a believer. I believed that the experts, the specialists, had a method. And also, many of these drugs were deadly alone, and even more so in combination. So I was very naive, and I believed that the safety of the patient was paramount, and I believed that the experts with special training knew how to combine these things in a way that was safe and effective for patients. I did a rotation in addiction. I was surprised to see that when the psychiatrist would interview the patient, he would ask, "How are you feeling?" At no point was the patient returned to his pre-sickness, drug-free state. So in rehab, we took the patients off their abusing drug, whether it was alcohol, cocaine, marijuana, whatever, and the physician merely prescribed the drug to address the sadness, the agitation, or insomnia, and at no point resolve the patient's issues. So once a month, we'd do a grand case review. We'd review not only the people who were inpatient, but sometimes we'd also review information about our graduates, and we're especially proud of our successful graduates. So once a month, we'd do this review. And I was surprised to learn that many of our stellar graduates, people who had graduated from the drug treatment program and had successfully stayed sober, died of a heart attack, generally within 2 years, 2 to 3 years. I was still in medical school. I had to spend several months learning how to prescribe drugs in order to prevent heart attacks. This was the first 2 years before I got into the drug rotation, or the drug course that I took instructing me in this matter of addiction. So here I am. I've already been trained how to prevent heart attacks by prescribing blood pressure medications. And back then, cholesterol medications weren't really big, but they were suggested. And now I'm being taught a system of medical practice that increases heart disease and death. As always, I had infinite faith that this contradiction would be resolved. It would soon be clear that this was really benefiting the patient. And so the practice we now know of prescribing prescription drugs, substituting them for the drugs of addiction, illegal drugs, really does not work. And so we have, of course, the tragedy of not only Whitney Houston, but Michael Jackson. In Michael's case, I believe he started off with illegal drugs and just stuck with them. So the statistics the government keeps on the impact of drug addiction often eliminates or excludes alcohol and cigarettes, including only the illegal drugs. So these statistics are, of course, suspect. So I want to talk a little bit more about the actual system itself of rehab and of treatment, so we can kind of get a better view of really what's going on. Now, the big picture is that rehab globally, when I say globally, I mean in the United States, is a $7 billion a year industry. Now, that's not a big chunk of change when you figure the whole healthcare industry is in the area of $2 trillion. And again, these are old numbers, approaching $3 trillion now in 2013, but this is back in 2012, early 2012. And so the question is, why is rehab ineffective? And, of course, one reason it's ineffective is people leave rehab. And so rehab is ineffective because we'll leave, but could they be leaving because rehab is ineffective? Let's see what the reasons are. And this is a pro-rehab site. And so I say some people leave because they didn't want to go there in the first place. And what they're saying is, I think it's a good reason to leave. But the rehab centers, of course, will get revenue when people stay. They don't think it's a good reason to leave. So they didn't want to be there in the first place. Another reason. The individual felt overwhelmed by their withdrawal symptoms and did not feel willing to continue with the process. Now, that tells me that the process was akin to torture and was very, extremely difficult and uncomfortable. And so it's a failure on the part of the rehab center to develop the process that's more acceptable and tolerable to the individual. Next reason for leaving. Person decides they don't like rehab. Again, get a customer service issue. Next issue. They come to the conclusion they do not need rehab and they'll be able to enter recovery without such help. And statistics bear this out. If the person on their own does 25% success rate and the rehab center does 12.5% or even less, then this is fairly accurate. Next, the individual is ambivalent about recovery. Not fully committed. Sounds like a great reason to leave to me. Next, person can decide that they are not like the other people in rehab and they don't want to be around these other people. And I think it's an adult decision that if you are around people that you don't like, that are not pleasing to you, I think you should be able to leave. Next, some people decide they know everything that rehab has to teach them and they leave. And this is possible. It might be that they come to rehab, they realize they've heard all this before, and they don't see how their ability to act on it is being increased. So that sounds like a pretty good reason to leave. Next, individuals lost control of their emotions and has left rehab out of anger. Again, I think this is a mature thing to do. It beats staying around and having physical confrontations. I think if people are unhappy someplace, that's the reason to leave. The next question, of course, which the rehab center may want to ask, is why are they feeling this way? Next, and this is the clincher, hold on to your hats on this one. People have unrealistic expectations of rehab and become disillusioned. They use this as an excuse to leave. Well, wait a minute. If you're not getting what you came for or what you think was promised, I think that's a good reason to leave. So, again, this is all from the rehab people themselves. And so they're saying that what's the danger of leaving rehab early? Now, this is important because rehab is supposed to be useful. It's supposed to be effective. So, of course, the danger of leaving rehab early is this guy has some negative impact on this person's life, right? Somehow, if they leave rehab early, you'd expect they might have some kind of life impact that's more devastating than had they stayed. So we're looking for here some good news, improved outcome from staying. So let's see what the rehab people themselves say. Dangers of leaving early. One, the individual will not be prepared for the transition back home, and they might be overwhelmed by familiar temptations. That is a common thing that happens when they do stay and complete their rehab. Okay, so that's not a reason to, it's not a danger. If the individual feels like they have a bad experience, this might also lead them to go back to alcohol and drugs. Well, that's back where they were. They were on alcohol and drugs when they came. And those who flee treatment, while overly emotional, will not be able to think rationally, and so are likely to make bad choices. Okay. Now, what we're looking for here is a statement from the rehab centers themselves, the pro-rehab industry, that rehab is important, rehab will keep this person sober, this person will benefit, and they're giving up a tangible benefit, and we want the rehab center to tell us what that benefit is. And it says, nobody knows how many chances the individual will get at recovery. By leaving rehab, the individual might be blowing their only chance of a good life. Well, wait a minute, what's a good life? And you know, this is pretty vague stuff. And we know that at the end of 1 month of rehab, most people, the large majority, it's just not enough for them. And so the individual can use this bad experience as an excuse to never consider rehab again. Now, how is that a bad thing? Maybe he needs to try something else. A person may tell drinking or drug-using friends of their bad experience. And this could discourage other individuals from seeking rehab. Okay, so the person might share their bad experience and create bad PR for the rehab industry. Okay, the person may become a marketing liability. Next, family and friends are likely to be disappointed by the failure to stay the course of rehab. And this is actually a really compelling issue because family and friends are actually paying the tab for at least 20% of all rehab. And so it may mean that they struggle to ever trust that person again, right, because they just spent all this money and the person is leaving. So, again, this doesn't speak to a personal benefit to the individual. And so the next and final justification or danger is if the person leaves rehab and replaces and relapses, it can lower their self-efficiency or effectiveness and their belief in their own ability to escape addiction. So if he leaves rehab early and relapses, then he'll lose confidence in himself. But what if he stays the full time and then relapses? Who knows? So there's no benefit to the patient of staying in rehab. At no point are the rehab people claiming that rehab is going to be helpful. And they go on to say there's no justification for leaving rehab early. And this is, again, very, very incriminating because this is where you want to hear it, right? Hey, you guys, what have you got to offer? What are you going to do for the patient? And what do they say? Nothing. If the patient feels disappointed because their life is not automatically perfect, they cannot use this as a reasonable excuse to check out of rehab. It will take time and effort to get their life back on track, and rehab is just an important first step. What? An important first step? A $6,000 a month, $8,000 a month, $120,000 a month first step? Well, wait a minute. How many steps are there? At $6,000 a step, that's a lot of money to spend on a first step. And how much is the second step going to cost? And what does that look like? And will that be another 3, 5, 10 months? What about the third step? And most people would expect 1 month and 7,000, 1 month of their life to $7,000 of their money, or a relative investment, to get more than just one step out of the issue. So this is probably a really outstanding reason someone to leave rehab, because they realize this rehab experience is not really going to move them that far forward. And so, and then we have on the internet, I love this, internet marketing is wonderful. It says, why do so many people go to rehab in Delray Beach? And it says, any rehab you go to in Delray Beach is going to be a step above most other treatment centers in the nation. They offer excellent location, very nice facilities, extra amenities, and specializations of all kinds. There's nothing lacking here at any rehab in Delray Beach. Basically, what they're saying, it reads like a real estate ad. And so, again, the difference between one rehab center and another apparently is not effectiveness. And that definitely seems to be the case. Now, another issue that's going on is most rehab treatment is forced, is coerced. That means the person doesn't have a choice. They're facing jail time or rehab. So the question is, what about forced treatment? does it really work? Is it, when you tell people, hey, you better get treatment or you're going to jail, do those people tend to have a better outcome? This can be difficult to sort out, but there's actually three groups to look at. One is people who don't go to jail and don't go to rehab. Then there's the ones who go to rehab instead of jail, and then there's the ones who go to jail instead of rehab. So you have the jail group compared to the rehab group compared to the I'll do it myself, thank you group. These are three groups. Now, these are not compared head up, but we do have different statistics so we can take a look at it. So what the rehab people are saying, and we're just looking at the rehab people, saying despite the popular belief you have to hit rock bottom before you can get better, people forced into treatment programs have similar outcomes to people who enter into treatment for other reasons. So in other words, if you go to rehab because the judge sent you there or because you signed up yourself, the outcomes are the same. And in this particular case, they looked at overall recovery rates at 24 months post-treatment. And they looked at methamphetamine use, which means it did not include marijuana or cocaine users, which may be kind of a different group. And so, interestingly, one factor that affected the success rates of both coerced, that means forced, and voluntary treatment seekers was duration of treatment. Universally, people who stayed in treatment for longer periods had better outcomes than people who finished with treatment more quickly. Now, this is actually spurious, since anyone can leave rehab at any time they choose. So people who stay longer, that's a voluntary choice, and therefore it's not a randomly selected population. So those who choose to stay longer are the same people who would likely have been sober anyway. And so, again, it's not an indication about rehab at all. And so why does coerced treatment work as well? There's all kinds of different theories here. But what they measure is failing fewer drug tests, 29% if they had treatment versus 46% if they didn't have treatment, and less likely to get rearrested, 52% who got treatment versus 62%. The difference in rearrest rate is actually very small. However, this is not evidence it works. Because the comparison group that's lacking is those who want to quit, but like I said, do so on their own without rehab. Now, I volunteered in a prison. I gave lectures on natural healing and diet. And what I saw was tons and tons of pasteurized milk, white bread, and vitamin B deficient foods being stocked in the kitchen. A diet like that would make an addict out of anybody. I mean, sober people submitted to that situation would be more likely to be addicts. Now, the government's position, now we're going to .gov sites, is that medications are an important element of treatment for many patients, especially when combined with counseling and other behavioral therapies. So they're suggesting methadone, Buspar, naltrexone. Now, naltrexone is an issue. Naltrexone is the drug to help people stay off of heroin, but is also experienced increased use as a pain medicine. And what we're now experiencing is many naltrexone deaths in the non-drug-using population that has prescribed naltrexone for reasons of pain relief. And so that is a bothersome issue. Also, medically assisted detoxification is only the first stage of addiction treatment and by itself does little to change long-term drug abuse. This is from the government.gov site. So they are saying medically assisted detoxification, basically rehab, does little to change long-term drug abuse. And yet, they are not only paying for it, not only forcing private insurance plans to pay for it, but paying for it themselves and allowing judges to prescribe this therapy. Now, here's another thing to look at. I remember when I was a kid, again, grew up in the ghetto, right? So we heard all this stuff on the TV telling us that blacks had this big drug problem, was a problem with poor people, and you know, on and on and on. But let's go to the .gov site and see what .gov has to say about this. So .gov, this is CDC, Center for Disease Control, And this is their, one of their bulletins they put out in 2012. What they said was, they looked at drug-induced deaths. They only included, one, drug overdoses, and two, adverse effects from drugs taken as directed, and infections resulting from drugs are not included. So drug-induced deaths were measured, but alcohol was not included, and taking drugs promptly was not included. So you can imagine it's a pretty small number. Even though this was the case, the drug overdoses were drug-induced deaths, rather, in 2007, were more common than alcohol-induced or firearm-related deaths in the United States. And here's the kicker: whites were more likely to die a drug-related death than any other ethnic group in the United States, more than blacks, more than Hispanics, more than Pacific Islanders, or even Alaskan Natives. Now, again, alcohol is not included, so that might excuse, I'm sure it did excuse things. What I'm trying to get at here is this drug overdose or drug death situation is huge. It really affects all groups. Now, they say these deaths are largely due to the growing popularity of powerful prescription pain and anxiety drugs, which are often highly addictive and dangerous when combined with other drugs such as alcohol. So prescription drugs now account for more deaths than heroin and cocaine combined. And so this is even when they exclude deaths from most properly prescribed medications. So this is a huge problem. Now, what's the point here? The point here is that everyone is at risk for this issue. And what has happened, I think, in terms of political jockeying, is there's been an attempt to paint this as an issue that only affects one race or not another race to create disunity on the topic. When actually, really, this is a big one I think we all need to get behind on, you know, trying to understand what's going on here. And so the rise in deaths is due to powerful prescription pain and anxiety drugs. Now, that's pretty plain. You're talking about the antidepressants and the ADHD drugs. Now, this is another piece to let you know how ineffective this is, the rehab. The National Institute on Drug Abuse is funding, this is 2013, April 2013, the Treatment Research Institute in Philadelphia, directed by Tom McLellan, former deputy director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy, to create and test a science-based method of rating treatment quality and determining the likelihood of favorable outcomes of treatment programs. In other words, they're still doing research because it doesn't work. And now they want to work with consultants from Consumer Reports so they can start marketing research centers. And a very capable columnist wrote an article about his son who ended up in rehab, and it took him 6 years, 6 admissions, in order to become clean for 5 years. And the figure he received was 30% who complete rehab or clean at 12 months. And they didn't count the ones who did not complete rehab. And so he feels his son is fine and sober. And he says, after a hellish decade, my son got and stayed sober. His current treatment regimen includes regular sessions with a psychiatrist who sees him for his addiction and co-occurring bipolar disorder and depression. He's been in recovery now for 5 years. And the majority, you know, but the nation's 20 million addicts, only 10% will ever receive treatment. And the majority of those who do will be failed by the existing system. Nick is one of the lucky ones. I'm one of the lucky ones. But this should not be about luck. He's correct that it shouldn't be about luck. But he doesn't realize even the 10% who get treatment are subjecting themselves to a system of luck. And that if his son is receiving medications for his bipolar disorder and depression, then he is receiving the class of drugs that's responsible for the increase in drug-related deaths. So, not out of the woods yet. So, how is this paid for? If we follow the money, that helps a lot. In this one, the money trail is a zigzag trail. So, I've got to stick with me on this money trail here. So how is it paid for? 45% of people actually pay for rehab out of their personal savings. That, to me, is a shocker. 30% use private insurance. Now, these percentages are going to add up to more than 100% because some rehab stays are paid for maybe out of part personal savings, part insurance, part a relative, part this, part that. So they're going to add up to more than 100%, but this is the partial percentages. So 45% of all treatments, a person has out-of-pocket expense. 30% private insurance is involved. 20% Medicaid is involved. 20% a relative pitches in. 15% Medicare, that's the old folks program. 7% the courts actually pay. 2% military, and 2% employer. And so what we're seeing here is we have an industry that's basically creating an incredible amount of poverty. I mean, $8,000 a month to go into not only your personal savings, but your relative, this is going to definitely lower your standard of living if you have to submit to this 8 times before you get recovery. The industry, of course, as always, is fraught with difficulties. You know, Allison Knopf wrote a book saying that referrals are being paid for, of course, that patients were deceived by being told insurance would cover the whole visit when actually it didn't. There are bills for brain scans and other unproven interventions, and really the patients were just being bilked. Now, this is only $7 billion with $2 trillion health tab, so there's got to be some money someplace else, and so we have to take a look someplace else. And where do we find this? 46.8% of federal prison inmates are in on drug charges. Now, obviously, if rehab worked and no one took drugs, then there wouldn't be anyone to bring up on drug charges because the sellers wouldn't have anyone to sell to. So you need to have a rehab program that doesn't work in order to have the $39 billion budget, which we see for federal prisons. We haven't even talked about juvenile detention centers, county prisons, and so on. So we have a $39 billion tip of the iceberg here. And this is the bottom line, why rehab cannot work. If it did work, it would be declared a threat to national security, which, of course, it would be. Well, let's take a look at the positive side. What can you do naturally? What can you do naturally to beat this? And it turns out there's actually a lot you can do naturally, and it's actually very effective. The first thing to understand is what is drug addiction. Now, I'm going to throw in the whole ball of wax here. I'm going to say cigarettes, alcohol, coffee, prescription narcotic drugs, cocaine, and heroin. Let's just include those in our list. And we'll throw in marijuana, too. Because the truth of the matter is, once you solve your underlying issue as to what is causing addiction, most people lose their drive or their addictive desire for the drug. So what is the underlying disease? The underlying disease is a B vitamin deficiency. That's it. Once the B vitamin deficiency is remedied, if it's remedied early on, that's all that needs to be done, and boom, you've got a cure in your hands. Now, how early is early on? It's actually usually pretty early. But what happens once a person has a B vitamin deficiency? First of all, you have three organs in the body that use a lot of B vitamins. And when there's not enough B vitamins, one of them has got to basically take a fall. I mean, like, fall on your sword and say, okay, I will reduce my level of functioning. I will not use B vitamins, so the other two organs can have B vitamins. What are these three organs? They are the brain, the heart, and the liver. Those are the three organs that use a lot of B vitamins. So this is why when you're under mental or emotional stress, your brain's going to use a lot of B vitamins, and then you're going to have, say, a heart attack or problems with your liver. Your liver's not going to filter. You have more chemicals in circulation. Then you can have all kinds of secondary illnesses and conditions such as arthritis, cancer, whatever. But these are the three organs that use B vitamins in large amounts. So if you have a shortage of B vitamins, one of these three organs has got to lower its level of functioning, K, dramatically in order for the person to stay alive. Your body will not do that by itself. This is why the good die young. They don't use drugs. Instead, they just keep living, trying to just push through the B vitamin deficiency. They get a heart attack and drop dead, stroke and drop dead, or their liver stops failing and they die, or they die of a secondary condition created by the liver malfunctioning. So primary is the B vitamin deficiency. So what happens after you've had a B vitamin deficiency for a while? Well, once you've had a B vitamin deficiency for a while, you develop damage to your body's tissues and to various organs. And that damage has to be repaired and restored, in addition to the B vitamin deficiency being restored, in order for a person to recover from addiction. And so this is why when in medical school we treated people with abstinence and boom, they were dead in 2 or 3 years of a heart attack. Why? Because we didn't correct your B vitamin deficiency. We just told them, wait, you may not use this drug. You're a bad person for using a drug. Be a good person. Stop using drugs and just go forward. So that was the failure of the model of simple abstinence. It really is not very effective. And as you can see by, as I said, Whitney Houston, not only that, but this reporter who wrote an article about his son going into great detail on his son, even though he's not using drugs, is still experiencing depression, still experiencing emotional difficulties that are requiring medical intervention. So again, the person has not been restored to health. So the first thing is to understand that. So the B vitamin deficiency is key, and next is the secondary malnutrition. What's the other issue? Why is it that rehab centers actually have a worse record for success than people who try on their own? Well, the answer should be clear, right? The center abruptly withdraws all the drugs, leaves the person in a state of total free fall and crisis, and then tells them, deal with it. Well, the person is suffering amounts to a medical emergency, and they're being told to just man up. Well, some things that's not an appropriate response to. Okay, so the approach of abruptly taking away, a cold turkey if you want to call it, the drugs is not the safest, most effective way. So what's the first place to start? The first place to start, if someone is using drugs, this depends on the kind of drugs that you're using, but let's just say we're talking about marijuana, or we're talking about cigarettes, or we're talking about coffee. Works very nicely for these three. You want to switch to the organic version of whatever the drug is. For people who are drinking coffee, if they switch to the organic version, at least they don't get the chemical pesticides that are going to stress their liver and increase their need for B vitamins. So that is important. People who switch to who are smoking cigarettes should switch to organic tobacco with clean, natural paper. And this is going to sound barbaric, but roll their own cigarettes. What does this do? This gets rid of all the chemicals that are put in the cigarettes to help it burn faster so the cigarette is used up, the pesticides, the chemicals in the tobacco. It makes it a much less toxic product. And so many people are actually able to reverse their cigarette side effects just by switching to organic cigarettes, in which case at that point, there's not any health urgency about quitting the cigarette. So switch to organic and roll your own. If you don't want to roll your own, then buy the tobacco and the papers and have a good friend or loved one roll them for you. This has really shocked me at the amazing improvement people have had just by going to organic cigarettes. And the same with marijuana. Again, it has really shocked me to see how many marijuana smokers are experiencing issues because of the additives put in their marijuana. Now, it could be anything. It could be a pesticide like paraquat. It could be laced with a secondary drug like heroin or cocaine. There's all kinds of things that apparently can be hidden in marijuana. So if you are going to even think about using any of these drugs, whether it's coffee or marijuana or cigarettes, and I would even add alcohol to that, switch to the organic version without chemicals. And like for wine, for example, you want the wine without the sulfites, and that's organic. That will give you an immediate improvement. Okay, so let's say, so start with that, got that done. The next thing you do is now is the time to add in your vitamins. And my favorite is B-Complex 50. Why? It covers the waterfront. It has a range of B vitamins in there, and it has to be vitamins at a high enough concentration, 50 milligrams per capsule, that it can replace the B vitamin deficiency fast enough to give the person relief. But what's the dose? The dose is generally 2 capsules 2 times a day. So that's your B-Complex 50 dose. Some people also have a mineral deficiency, especially with alcoholics, and they just simply take magnesium or magnesium oxide. That dose is 400 milligrams. Now, so now you're cooking. You've got this addict. This works, by the way, you can do this for the cocaine people and the heroin people as well. So now you've got this addict. We haven't got them off this drug yet, but they're feeling better. The next step is to change your diet, and you've got to change your diet next, because if you don't change the diet, then the person's going to have a much more difficult time of it. But when I was in medical practice, I was able to get people off their drugs actually without changing their diet very much. But since then, and working with more people, I found that changing their diet makes it so much easier for everybody. I mean, for them, for their relatives, it's just a much smoother, smoother course. So what should they do? Okay, so everyone's on whatever drug they're using the organic, chemical-free version of it. They're taking B-Complex 50, 2 twice a day. If you're a smoker or a coffee drinker, you're going to need licorice root, 1 teaspoon a day. We talked about licorice root last time as an adaptogen, and that's exactly what it's doing here. It's just recalibrating your body so it adapts, and you have that flexibility, and you don't need the drugs to adapt. So it's just really, really wonderful. So it's 1 teaspoon a day. You can take that as a tea, or now they have licorice root tea bags. How advanced. And so you can take a tea bag of licorice root, put it in a cup, pour boiling water over it, let it steep at least 5 minutes, and sip it. The only thing is to try and get through the whole cup in a day. Most people can do that easily in an hour. It actually doesn't taste bad. It's kind of sweet. The next thing you need to do is, whoever this addict is, needs to kind of educate themselves to the dangers of not only the drug that they're eating, that they're abusing, but the dangers of the foods they're eating that are leading them to use the drug. So, in other words, white sugar is a hazard. Why? Because all the B vitamins are removed from the sugar, and so as soon as a person eats the sugar, they have an immediate B vitamin deficiency. White bread, same thing. The B vitamins have been removed from the bread, so as soon as a person eats a piece of white bread, which is wheat, by the way, and so noodles, that's more white flour, they experience an immediate B vitamin deficiency. So people need to get rid of those foods. Now, since the old days, a lot more things have happened. Things are a lot more sophisticated with genetically modified food. If people would avoid that, that would be huge, because that makes the liver work harder trying to filter and sort things out. So people who are addicted, let's just say money is no object, you should get a what's called a kitchen garden in your backyard, raise the vegetables yourself, or hire a gardener, and that's what you eat. You eat from that kitchen garden. If you want to eat meat, fine, put some chickens out in the backyard, and that's pretty much your diet. You could stop by the health food store and get some organic beans every now and then, or organic grains, or if there's some organic produce that you don't grow in your backyard. But really, that is what needs to be done. And I think as an addict, looking at $7,000 for a month of rehab, you should be able to get yourself a garden going in the backyard with a gardener for less than $2,000 a month. And then once the gardener gets everything set up for you, you could probably get things going. I found that a plot that was 4 feet by, I believe it was 4 feet by 12 feet, raised beds, four of those easily fed a family of four. And so that's kind of a benchmark as to how much space you're going to need. Now, so cold turkey does not work. So what do? You give the person these vitamins, you change your diet, and they will actually tell you that they want less drugs. They will actually start using less drugs. Many alcoholics, if that's what you want to call them, people who drink a lot of alcohol, will actually just stop drinking. They say, well, you know, I just don't feel like, I don't feel a desire. I'm not interested. And people are really amazed at this. So that's alcohol. Actually, alcohol is pretty easy to quit with this method. Cigarettes are a little more challenging. With cigarettes, you really absolutely need the licorice root. You absolutely need the B complex. You do need a little bit of determination. So alcohol, I mean, cigarettes are more difficult to quit. With cigarettes, it's very diet dependent. If a person eats a spaghetti dinner, they're going to feel like a cigarette right after the dinner because they've gotten a big rush of a drain on their B vitamins, and they're going to need to smoke that cigarette to kind of get them over the hump. So you want to go to whole foods that are organic. And again, nothing beats the backyard. That is the best. So cold turkey is not necessarily a reasonable way to go. So your cocaine user will usually, many people are multiple drug users. So you're looking at maybe someone who uses cigarettes, coffee, alcohol, and then throw in another drug there, a marijuana or something else. So most people are going to be able to peel away their heroin, cocaine, or marijuana pretty easily. Then they're going to be able to peel away their alcohol. And then they're going to be able to peel away their coffee and finally the cigarettes. So each one of these, so drugs have varying degrees of difficulty in terms of how difficult it is to quit these drugs. And so simply putting a person, changing the circumstances of their diet and the nutrition is going to change their need or craving for drugs and can actually return them to a pre-sickness state. Now, also what helps people is some level of detoxing, increasing their bowel movements to, say, three a day, eating things like charcoal, which will soak up chemicals that their body's trying to release. And so it can take a few questions. If people have any questions, click their little thing and can ask questions. But that really is the solution. And so when you take a look at what I saw going on in prisons, which is serving white bread, serving sugary, syrupy things, serving packaged food, pasteurized, chemical-filled milk, you realize that the program in the prison is one of drug induction, one of creating a drug dependency. And later on, in about 4 weeks, we're going to have some people actually who are from a prison talk about the prison organization, what happened when the drugs were taken out of the prison, how that was done, and how the drugs got back in the prison. That's really exciting. But the rehab swindle is this. The rehab swindle is actually $38 billion the judicial system is consuming and would not need to be consumed if people were not addicted. And so it's important for people to be addicted and to stay addicted. Now, of course, there's the story behind that story, which is that the government may actually be the primary supplier of drugs, and that's a whole other ball of wax and a whole other level of benefit. But the point is, if people kick their drug habits, it would create incredible financial dislocation. And the addicts themselves are pawns to a far greater gain. However, the solution lies in your kitchen, in your very own house, in your very own hands. This is something that you can easily take into your hands and handle. And for people whose relatives are addicted, usually if you're the primary relative, that would be you live with the person like you're the parent or spouse or something like that, then it's really nothing to present them with vitamins to swallow every day. Usually they'll say, oh, yeah, okay, fine. They'll swallow that and then go on about whatever it is they're doing. And many so-called addicts are actually very high-functioning. In other words, they're able to go to work and to live even though they may be using drugs. And so for this reason, providing them with a nutritional change, it gives them a chance to voluntarily reduce their drug use, maintain their employment, and really improve the outlook of their life without being tortured. I'm going to do station identification here. You're listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels on the Rainbow Soul channel at BlakeRadio.com. Please visit our sponsor, that's me, and get your copy of Do You Have the Guts to Be Beautiful? This anti-aging book is available at VitalityCapsules.com/truth-files. Get your copy of this book that has helped men and women look and feel 20 years younger. So be the first in your circle to get those envious inquiries and those admiring glances. So you no longer have to fear wrinkles. You can erase them at will. So that book again is Do You Have the Guts to Be Beautiful? It's available at vitalitycapsules.com/truth-files. And as always, I welcome your calls and questions. And you can call in at 914-338-0695. We have 60 seconds left. So please email me. Let me know what you'd like to hear about in upcoming episodes. We have one episode coming up in a few weeks on vaccines, actually it's October 1st, and another one, as I said, on the prison system, which is really, really an eye-opening, but also very entertaining. And so I was involved with that for 10 years, so, but I felt that you guys would like to hear another perspective. So we got the head honchos to agree to come chat with us. That's really very exciting. And so with that, I'm going to sign off, and we'll see you next week.